Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Grand Rapids and earned an aeronautical engineering degree from the University of Michigan. He joined the Marines, became a pilot, and was one of 19 astronauts selected by NASA in 1966. He spent 59 days in space as the pilot for Skylab 3 and logged 8 days in space as the spacecraft commander on STS-3 while spending 11 hours walking in space. His name? Colonel Jack Lausma, a modern-day Renaissance man. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to a modern-day Renaissance man. His life consisted of being an astronaut, military leader, scientist, politician, business executive, husband, father, man of faith, Colonel Jack Lausma.
Well, Jack, it's always great to talk with you, and especially after these years that we've been apart somewhat, it's always good to get together on the telephone. And I've admired your show so much, and to be number 750 is quite a remarkable achievement for yourself.
Thank you. Thank you. Can we start by talking about your childhood in Grand Rapids and your mom and your dad, please?
Sure. I think I can remember well that back that far. I was born in 36, so about 5 years before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. My parents had been farmers' kids, and they were married and over near Holland and Zealand in that area and moved to Grand Rapids. My father was a machinist at the Keeler Brass, and my mother was a practical nurse at one of the hospitals. And I came along after a while in 36, and about that time, of course, the war had broken out, and my father wanted to enlist like so many people did. You'd be amazed at how many people were involved across the country in World War II compared to how many are involved in military actions these days in the country. All the civilians, everybody knew someone who was over there or had a parent over there, had a brother or sister, uncle or an aunt over there fighting the war, and not on a furlough either to come home every 6 months, but stay over there until it was over. In any case, my father tried to enlist, and he was rejected because he was almost deaf. He was a little older as well, but he wanted to contribute to the war effort, so he took a job at the bomber plant in Willow Run Airport near Ypsilanti. And he commuted to Grand Rapids for about a year on the weekends, and he got tired of that, so we moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and that's where I grew up. We stayed for a couple of years in the upstairs bedroom of my uncle's house until we could afford to have a rented apartment of our own. But during all that time, my father worked as a riveter on the wings and out the B-24s, and later was an engineer at the power plant at the University of Michigan. So that was my early beginnings, and my uncle and aunt, of course, where we were staying, had two boys in the service. They were both pilots, one in the Navy and the other in the Army Air Corps, as it was called then. After a year or so, the pilot and the officers in the Air Corps was killed in an airplane crash, and so that was a sad day at my uncle and aunt's home when we were there during that period of time. And in those days, we would have a banner in the window, a number of stars on it, depending on how many kids you had in the service, and they had two blue stars. Of course, that day, one of them turned to gold.
You fell in love with aviation. You joined the Marines to become a pilot in 1959, and then about 1965, Jack Lausma, you answer an ad in a newspaper.
That's true. I thought being an astronaut was one of those situations where it was don't call us, we'll call you, so I didn't think I'd ever have a chance to be in a space program, although I was watching it fairly closely. I was a young aviator. I didn't have the qualifications early in my career, and I did watch the Mercury program and Gemini and so forth, and at the time I was in a photo reconnaissance squadron on the East Coast, and I loved that work. We had high-speed supersonic photo airplanes and so forth, and kind of took care of the area down in the Caribbean and had a lot of good experiences. But as I was leaving the base one evening on a Friday, the sentry handed me a newsletter about the base, just a four-page thing. Front page said had an article that said, any Marine who can qualify is invited to send an application to the Commandant of the Marine Corps. NASA's looking for new astronauts. And I thought, well, I'd have thought this was don't call us, we'll call you. I was wrong all this time. And when I said, I'll never make this because there'd be 10,000 people apply. But I'd kick myself forever if I didn't try when I had the chance. And so I sent in an application and went through all of the mail, and the Marine Corps sent me and a few other Marines to NASA, along with Navy and Air Force and civilian pilots. And NASA then trimmed that number down to 19. So I was one of 19 new astronauts to join NASA in 1966. We had two Marines, and the rest were Navy and Air Force and a few civilian test pilots.
And up until that point, there had only been 30 astronauts. So you then jumped it up to 49.
That's okay. Correct. And we made about 50, and the original seven astronauts were still there. John Glenn, Al Shepard was my boss. And so we joined quite an astute crowd. Most of them had already flown in space, and so they were obviously the ones that were going to fly first in the Apollo program. And the rest of us were working our way up the line, I guess you might say.
January 27th, 1967, the disastrous fire on the launch pad. We lose Gus Grissom, Ed White, Roger Chaffee. What do you remember about that day?
I had just arrived home after work. I got a call from my secretary saying there's been a fire at the Cape and the three astronauts have been lost. So I headed back for the Mission Control Center to see what I could do to help. It was a disastrous event. Spacecraft or space flight's a hazardous business, and so is aviation. And so most all of us have been military pilots for quite a long time, and we never get used to seeing our buddies die, but it happened quite often. And so here we were with this problem with Gus and Ed and Roger. Roger, of course, is from my hometown in Grand Rapids.
We're talking to Colonel Jack Lausma, who traveled some 27,800,000 miles in Earth's orbit. When we come back, we're going to ask him about July 20th, 1969. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasul, and we're with Colonel Jack Lausma. Jackson, let's go back to July 20th, 1969. Hard to believe, 50 years ago. What do you remember about that day?
Yes, that was the first landing on the moon, and we lived a block away from Neil Armstrong. We were most of us in the same neighborhood, and Neil would be out there raking leaves with his boys and taking them fishing and working with the Boy Scouts and so forth. So he was the regular guy as a person, but he was one outstanding aviator, and he was the right one to get the job. I'm glad that he was able to be the first on the moon. And so that was an exciting time. I took my son outdoors that evening, and went up on the roof, and he said, "Hey, Dad, I think I can see him up there, can't you?" But there was a huge commotion down the street, all the lights and spotlights and the reporters and people and general public wanting to hear from the family and so forth. But it was a night of great and happy commotion, and we watched the hill. Moonwalk, of course, on our black and white television set at home.
This is from an article in March of 2001, NASA Oral History, where they're quoting you. I think probably Apollo 11 and the space program was the first time that everybody around the world was glued to the news and glued to the TV sets watching this happen. It didn't matter what country one lived in or what the culture was or the language or the religion or anything. These astronauts were people who represented all of mankind, so to speak, and they wanted them to be successful. It didn't matter who it was, as long as someone or humans like them were involved. Tell us about the enormity of that achievement with the technology we had 50 years ago.
It was an enormous achievement compared to what we think of today, and you're right, everybody in the whole world was fascinated by this. The same effect occurred when we had the Apollo 13 accident. People around the world didn't think of themselves at that time in those circumstances as people of a country. They thought themselves as people of the Earth, and that these three guys who were out in space represented them. And they wanted them to be successful, and they're curious about it. We heard from just about every language and culture, I guess you might say, back at NASA, and people encouraging us along. And the fact that everybody was so excited and interested about it, of course, buoyed us up in the Mission Control Center.
Okay, let's go to Apollo 13, which launched on April 11th, 1970. And 2 days into the mission, disaster hits again. Where were you, Jack Lausma, when that happened?
Well, I was in the Mission Control Center, and I was the guy who was talking to the astronauts as the capsule communicator, or CAPCOM. I had worked on their mission and preparations. I had worked on getting their lunar module through test and checkout at the Cape, representing the crew and all the decisions that were made to make sure that they were made such that the crew would be happy with changes that had to be made and so forth. So I was very well versed and checked out in the lunar module, and they were in space at that time. They were just activating the lunar module, getting ready to go into orbit about the moon, and so they made a television program, which is a very interesting one, on the way back, on the way out. And so we were all fascinated by that. And parents and kids and grandkids and uncles and aunts and so forth of the crew were in the viewing room, and they left and went home. But before they got home, within 10 minutes, this explosion had occurred, and their whole life had changed from being absolutely confident and happy to one of severe concern and wonder. And we had to break the news to them as to what would happen, because that explosion happened before they got home.
Okay, we've had a problem here.
And my job as the capsule communicator was to talk to the crew. Only the capsule communicator can talk to the crew. Everybody else has to listen.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
And, of course, I didn't control the flight. The flight director controls what happens and works with all the flight controllers in the mission control room. And then between them decide what the crew needs to do and what they need to hear, and then tells the CAPCOM to send that word up. And so that was my job. I took the message, Houston, we've got a problem, and we really did. One of the major problems was that the explosion occurred and it had blown out all of the telemetry about the health of the spacecraft, so the flight controllers on the ground were getting very little information about what really happened. And so we went up several blind alleys for several minutes, and maybe 30, 40 minutes before we actually found out what the problem really was. And the only way we could find that out was by hearing what the crew said about their instruments, because theirs were working on the spacecraft, whereas that information just wasn't getting to the ground. And as time went on, we pieced together what the problem was and set about fixing it.
You told them they had to fire their rockets, that we're going to send them around the backside of the moon, and they were going to be out of contact for 40, 50 minutes. What did you all do when they were on the backside of the moon?
Well, when they're on the backside of the moon, we were planning what they were going to do when they came out around so we could talk to them again. They were out of commission, out of communication, of course, on the backside of the moon. So before the explosion occurred, they had already made an orbital adjustment such that they would, when they got to the moon, they would stay in orbit around the moon instead of just going around and coming home. And so they had already committed to being in orbit around the moon. And so when they came back around the backside, we had to give them all the information they needed to fire the engines to change all that from going into orbit about the moon to coming on a trajectory that brought them back home. So what we were working on while they were on the backside was what they were going to do when we got to communication with them again. And so everyone in the flight control room, whether they're involved with flight dynamics or communications or electrical power systems or environmental control and all that sort of thing, everybody had a job to do and contributed to the solution to bring them back. And when they got in the communication range, and again, we broadcast that information to them, and they executed the firing of the engine to get on their way back. And then we also had people in the simulators by this time who were setting up to be in the same condition as they were on the moon, because we had a limited supply of oxygen and cooling water and other properties that were in short supply, and we had to figure out a way to get them back without using all of those things up. And so we started means by which we could conserve all of those various supplies that they needed to get back, as well as to take carbon dioxide out of the cabin and one thing and another. And of course, they were pretty cold on the way back because we couldn't allow them to have much heat because it used up our electrical power, which was in the batteries of the lunar module. We didn't have any fuel cells that worked then, so make sure that we kept enough electricity so they could get the parachutes open when they got home.
We're talking to Colonel Jack Lausma. When we come back, we're going to ask him about the 59 days he spent in space in 1973. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Krasula, and we're with Colonel Jack Lausma. Jack, let's go back to July 28th, 1973. You're the pilot of Skylab 3, and you spend 59 days in space. What did you do up there for 59 days?
Well, you know, we were really busy. This was the first time that we had launched the real experimental laboratory into space with some 60 experiments to do, and it was larger than anything we'd lived in before, so we had to learn how to live in something that large. Otherwise, we're just living in these small capsules. So we are also trying to understand how to make a permanent space station. This was Skylab was just a temporary space station, three flights. Besides wanting to know how to make an international space station like we have up there now, we were doing a lot of medical experiments to see what happens to your body when you're in a weightless condition and how long you can stay there and if your body's going to work normally for some length of time. And so every 3 days we were doing medical experiments, and that information was telemetered to the ground so the doctors could decide whether or not we could stay there another 7 days. So it was a very, very little was known about being in a weightless condition. Of course, the flights to the moon, they had 1/6 gravity, and it's a lot different on your body than having zero gravity. So we did those experiments, and did medical experiments, but we were also doing solar physics. We were up above the atmosphere where we could study the sun without the interference of the atmosphere in front of our telescope, so we get 100% of the information that came from the sun. So we were all qualified to do the work, the six solar telescopes. We didn't have the privilege or the ability to take people that went up just for their specialty in those days. The pilots had to become scientists, and the scientists had to become pilots. So we're studying medicine, the aspects of long-range aspects of being in space physically, solar physics. We're studying the Earth and its resources to understand how we could use the ones we have more effectively and more efficiently, how we could find new ones. And we were doing those kinds of experiments. We had student experiments, high school student experiments, some materials processing experiments, technology experiments. We were really busy guys, and we really loved working up there. We worked about 16 hours every day, and then get 8 hours, about 6 hours of sleep at night, and just going around the world every 90 minutes, speed of 17,500 miles an hour. and 60 minutes in the daylight and 30 minutes in the shadow of the earth or the darkness. So we had 16 sunrises and sunsets every day. And you have to sleep fast and work fast, but that's the joke. We didn't do that. We slept when they were sleeping on the ground, so that we didn't have to have so many people at control center during the night. So we got all this experimental work done. We learned a lot of things that nobody knew before. Medically speaking, we came back with 10% or 20% less blood for some reason, and 10% fewer red cells, and we weren't making any new red cells. So there was concern we'd have to have an artificial rotating space station with artificial gravity. But it turns out the third crew that went up there, they started making new red cells, and they had the right amount of blood when they came back. But we were learning what we could do to mitigate some of those problems that occurred so that we could then be confident of going to the space station and staying there 4 months, 6 months, 8 months, a year now. And they've been having long flights with the International Space Station. But our job was to do the precursor work to see if we could do it to begin with and see what happened to us medically.
God's blessed you, Jack Lausman, so many ways. One of the greatest was you meeting Gracia and being her partner for 60-plus years. When a husband is in space for 59 days, how long did that gracious honey-do list get in those 59 days?
Well, you have to take your wife and your kids to do your job, I guess, when you're up there before you go. And it took a long time, but it was just great to be back, and that's for sure. We tried to stay longer, however, but when we were told we were coming home, we were eager to get back and be with the family and with the kids. And, of course, I've always found it necessary to involve Gracia and the kids in what I was doing, so we would go down to the launches at the Cape once in a while. We would also have them over the control center. They'd try on a little space suit or get in a simulator, and kept them involved so they would understand what was happening. And in Skylab, for the first time, we had some communication back home. And in fact, we had an opportunity to talk usually about, I believe it was once a week, for about 12 minutes. We would do that as we were over the Earth, over the United States, I should say, because there were three stations on the ground that were connected to each other, and that way we could talk for about 12 minutes. And me and mother wanted to know, we got a problem with the dishwasher. Who do I call? Or the kids got a problem with their grades in school, or the cats having kittens, or you know, a lot of things to talk about. But we also, I meant to mention this a while ago, your earlier question, that you have to remember that those were different days technology-wise. We didn't have personal computers. We had no cell phones. We had no communication satellites. We had no GPS. There's so many things that we did not have. We had actually a very elementary computer. Your cell phone has more capability than our computer to land on the moon or launch off the Earth had at the time. So we were working in a lot different technology kind of a situation than we are now, and a lot of what we did is spun off the technology that we are using now.
All right, then we jump ahead to 1982, and you're the commander for STS-3, and you spend 8 days in space, and between the 59 days and the 8 days, you completed 988 revolutions of the Earth, but you also walked in space for 11 hours. What's the difference from seeing the Earth in a space capsule versus seeing the Earth while walking in space?
Doing a spacewalk in orbit is the ultimate in going there. That's what everybody lives for, and those are the days I remember the most. It takes a while to get ready, and we were usually out there for 6 or 7 hours and then come in and recover from it. And on the spacewalks that we did, we were going to change the films and the cameras in the solar telescopes every so often. But ended up, we spent more time repairing the spacecraft and keeping it fit to stay in orbit by keeping the temperature down and so forth. We put a shade out over the living area because it lost its skin to begin with and it had to be covered. But when we go out and do a spacewalk, it's a lot different than being inside, as you said. When you're inside, you just see a small part of the Earth as you're looking through the window. But as you go outside, your total perspective changes because now you can see the whole 360 degrees of the Earth, see about 1,500 miles in every direction. And with this new perspective now, oh, by the way, the world is round. So if you're in the Flat Earth Society, get out of it because I can guarantee the world's round. And so now with this new three-dimensional perspective, you can sense your speed over the ground. But there's no sound, there's no vibration, there's nothing flopping in the breeze. It's just like gliding along on a magic carpet into the sunrise, into the sunset, into the sunrise, sunset 16 times every day and every hour and a half. And you want to stay there as long as you can. So you figure out ways to tell the ground that you're not quite finished with your job yet, or you find some more things you have to do. And it was easier to do in those days because we didn't have communication satellites, so you could talk to the ground all around the Earth. We just could talk when we were over ground station. Maximum would be 6 minutes, except over the U.S. where we had three of them and could talk for 12 minutes. But otherwise, you could sometimes miss all those ground stations and be out there and figure out a way to stay out there longer.
Just say, Houston, you're breaking up over there. Okay. When you're, it would take you 15 minutes to walk across America. When you were over the Mississippi, looking left, right, forward, what could you see, Jack Lausma?
Well, you could see the whole Mississippi from the northern border of the United States down to New Orleans. And I often think of people relate to Chicago, for example, near over Chicago. We could see halfway up Hudson Bay to the north. We see Washington, Baltimore, Denver, and New Orleans in just one 360-degree scan. So you had that long-range perspective, which you also could see with the naked eye. You could see freeways and cities, airports, river systems. You could see the blues of the ocean and the white of the clouds and the snow on the mountains. You could see the green and brown patchwork of the farmers' fields and the beautifully painted deserts, painted just the way the master painter painted them so many years ago in all their living colors that changed with the sun angle. And the world looks like a map. It looks just like a globe, like one you have at home or the kids have at school. But the one thing you can't see on that globe below it you're looking at are the boundaries that separate the countries. You can't see those red and black lines that weren't placed there when the world was created, but they're placed there by people mostly in their inability to get along with their neighbors, and they've been responsible then for all these disagreements and wars and different languages and cultures and so forth. So there's a philosophical message there, I think.
We're talking to Colonel Jack Lausma, who traveled some 27,800,000 miles in Earth's orbit. When we come back, we're going to ask him about the infinite vastness of our universe. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Colonel Jack Lausma, who in 1965 answered an ad in a newspaper to become an astronaut. And the rest is history. Jack, 988 revolutions of the Earth. Try to tell us about the vastness of our universe.
Should have been paid by the mile. In fact, if they stayed one more day, it made 1,000 revolutions. But 988 was enough. Yeah, when you're out there, you can see the Earth, and you really spend a lot of time looking at the Earth. Never get enough time to do it, but you have that outward look as well. You look out in the universe, and you say, "Well, this it must be a big place." And of course, your eye can't see that far, but we know that the end of the universe is infinite. The furthest thing out from which we can measure on a signal is about almost 14 billion light years out there. And that's a number that's too big to comprehend. You guys have to know what a light year is. A light year is the distance that light would travel in 1 year at its great speed of 186,300 miles per second. In fact, that's equivalent, that's too big a number to understand, but it's equivalent to going around the world 7.5 times every second. If you go that fast for 1 year, you'd go with 1 light year, which is 6 trillion miles. That's about, if you had a dollar for every mile, it'd be only a quarter of the national debt. So it's that big. And as we're thinking about the size of the universe, we think, of course, first about the rather small star, the mediocre sun around which we're orbiting. And our little sun is one of probably billions of stars in the Milky Way galaxy. The Milky Way galaxy is so big that if we wanted to cross it from end to end, we'd have to spend 100,000 years at the speed of light just across our own galaxy. In fact, we're not in the center of the galaxy either. We're out in halfway out toward the edge. And so we're actually 27,000 light years from the center. It would take us 27,000 years at the speed of light to get from the Earth to the center of our own galaxy. If we wanted to go to the next star, our next nearest star aside from our sun, we'd have to travel for 4.3 light years to Alpha Centauri, which is the closest star. If we wanted to go to the next galaxy, which is the Great Andromeda Galaxy, we'd have to travel for 2.2 million light years just to get to the next galaxy. And so you can see this is a big, big place in which we live, and we are so small within it. And there are so many galaxies in the universe now. In fact, since we got the Hubble Space Telescope, probably before the last time I spoke with you, Jack, Hubble Space Telescope tells us now that there are enough galaxies in this whole universe for each and every person in the whole country and a whole world, 7 billion people, to own 10 or 15 galaxies of their very own. Can you imagine how big that is? And so it makes you feel really small in terms of your world and the galaxy that you're in, and what a privilege we are to have to live in this planet. Some has called this the privileged planet because we have not found yet any other planets that have the quality that are required for life such as we know it here. Since we spoke last time, also with the telescopic capabilities we have, Jack, we have been investigating our own galaxy for other stars, other planets that might have stars. We found 2,000 to 3,000 of them so far, that stars that have a planet around them, but none of them would support life as we know it today. So as far as we know, we're still unique, and God has made us unique. And it's amazing, you know, that this great God that we know this great universe to control, to manage, and yet he takes care and has a desire for us to have a personal and close relationship with him on a daily basis. That's a fantastic relationship.
Speaking of our Heavenly Father, Lausma, when you were walking in space for the 11 hours, what did you say to God? What were your prayers to God?
My prayers were mostly for the thankfulness that I had the opportunity to see his universe in a new and different way than I'd ever seen it before, and most people never have a chance to see it, and to thank him for the goodness that he has in making it possible for me to do just what I was doing, and have this great appreciation that despite all he has to manage, that he still is concerned about me and my lifestyle, my future, and my plans, and my daily life, and a close and personal relationship with him.
You were very gracious in 2011 to write me your philosophy of life, and it's beautiful. And here's the last paragraph. You say, Jack, the last thing I want to say is Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. You were this engineer 270 miles up. Why are you sure there's a God, Jack?
There's got to be, because this whole universe all the galaxies, all the stars, they're so work together in such harmony. You don't see any disharmony out there. And so God is a great designer, a great project manager of all that he has. But the facts are that he is still concerned about us right down here on Earth. I likened it to saying that he has this telescope that he can see forever with his telescope, but he has a wide angle on the lens on it too, where he can zoom right in on planet Earth, right down into the down into Michigan, right down into my heart and the hearts of a people, and still know that he is there, that he is eager for a close and personal relationship with him. And that's what my wife and I have pursued all over the years, and we have been able to see his presence in our lives. He speaks to us in lots of different ways, not so much in words, but is in guiding and directing our futures. And we never anticipated the route that we would take, but it had not been for him and his plan for us and our willingness to follow it, it wouldn't have happened. And so he does not necessarily say words to us, but he arranges circumstances. He arranges our thought processes. He provides opportunities, and he changes our likes and desires, and enables us to make decisions based on those things he sends our way. It's kind of like, I guess you might say, like a compass. You can't see the magnetic lines that make this compass needle point from north to south, but you can see the effects of those lines on the needle. Same with electricity. You can't see that electricity going through the wires, but you can see its effect when you turn on the light. It's the same way when he speaks to us. I think he speaks to us through his word. He speaks to us through other people, through our conscience and through circumstances, and he helps us solve problems. He gives us purpose and meaning and identity in our lives, and he answers prayer, and he gives us a sense of peace and happiness. And so this great God who has this great universe to manage still is concerned about you and me and wants to have a personal relationship. And then that choice is up to us, and we made the choice for it. It's the best choice we ever made.
Jack Lausma, I really admire you. It's been fabulous to have a friendship with you for 20-plus years. Give my best to Gracia. God bless. Tonight marks our 750th show, and I'd like to thank the late, great Mike Feasey, who took a huge chance on me, our leader, Steve Fenateri, our station manager, Mike Wheeler, the magician with the knobs, Mark Blackwell, Kelly Fisher, our producer, editor, everything, and last but not least, most importantly, you, our listeners. It's been a 15-year honor and blessing for me. God bless. Spoholm.